call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, there we go. Today is Thursday, April 18, 2019, and the time is 1:30. With us today is Representative LeBron, Representative Tilton, Vice Chair Johnston, Representative Merrick, Representative Josephson, I'm Representative Co-Chair Wilson. Co-Chair Foster will be with us as soon as he completes his bill. And so with that, we're going to hear HB 32, Alaska Energy Efficiency Loans. We have received a letter from the Alaska Bankers Association. We want to do some follow-up on that particular letter that I just received. So we will be holding that bill over until next week. So with that will be HB 79, Peace Officer Firefighter Retirement Benefits. And with that, Representative Kopp, will you please put yourself on the record, bring any help you'd like to, and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I welcome up here with me my staff, Ken Truitt, and Tom Westcott of the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association. Thank you for hearing this bill today, committee members, which I believe powerfully addresses the two themes of the 31st legislature. One is the public safety challenges across the state right now, which I believe the very heart of which is our personnel recruitment and retention crisis. And the other is our fiscal situation, keeping our fiscal house in order. I want to thank the many leaders of our municipalities and boroughs across Alaska, as well as all the employees of the different public safety associations that have faithfully tracked and pursued a solution to this over at least a dozen years that would keep our best and brightest public safety professionals here at home in Alaska. And in this high-risk profession, God forbid, if they don't survive a career, that they would at least leave to their families some measure of security at home. I served, as many of you know, 23 years as a police officer. I worked in communities from Kenai to Anchorage to Bristol Bay in this profession, and some of the best and the toughest experiences of my life were found in this job. It was certainly hard on my wife and kids, and it was hard on my police family, but it's a job I would do all over again. It was worth it. The job is different. It really is. It begins with an oath. As a law enforcement officer, my fundamental duty is to serve all mankind, to safeguard lives and property, to protect the weak from oppression or intimidation, and to protect the peaceful from violence and disorder, and to respect the constitutional rights of all. It's a different job. In this work, you save people's lives. You solve terrible crimes. You walk with people through terrible grief and loss. And you help people put their lives back together. And if you're lucky, you get to help them keep their lives from falling apart to begin with, if you're there when it's needed. But it does come at a cost to our men and women in uniform, and nobody does the job for the money. There's many days when you can't pay them enough money to do the job. When you think about it, you run towards gunfire, you fight violently with bad guys, you go to bed sore, you wake up sore, you confront evil almost every day, you get hit, you get hurt, you risk your life, and sometimes you die. Police and firefighters do all this together. We can bicker like siblings, but in reality, we're as close as hands and feet. On Christmas Day, 2003, I was working at the Kenai Police Department when Senior Patrol Officer John Watson was gunned down in the line of duty, and we could not recover his body because he was in an area where the shooter had an open view and we couldn't approach where John was lying. We didn't figure that out. The police did not on our own. It was the firefighters that drove an engine up alongside the house where the shooter was and blocked its line of fire so we could go recover him. We get through the career together. The professions are almost inseparable in what we do every day. And you will hear from police and firefighter agencies from the North Slope to Ketchikan, from Bristol Bay to Kenai, that currently they are losing millions of dollars in training from officers and firefighters with 0 to 2 years of service that are leaving the state after being trained and certified to go to places that offer a more secure retirement plan. So what House Bill 79 does is it takes everything we learned in Tier 3 was don't pay benefits you can't afford. And it scales back those benefits and it delays the retirement eligibility. to make it so we don't lose our employees and we keep the retirement plan at a minimal risk. In this way, we provide a sure foundation for our employee retirement planning and stability for our employer cost control as we look out into the future. So thank you, Madam Chair, and if I may, I would like to now turn it over to Tom Westcott, who just has a few remarks.
Please put yourself on the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Westcott. I'm president of the Alaska Professional Firefighters. I'm also a captain with the Anchorage Fire Department at Station 5 in Spinard. I'd like to start by thanking the committee for the willingness to work on this important issue. This is an issue that's important to the men and women serving Alaska in public safety jobs. It's also important to the state as it wrestles with serious budget issues and a desire to tackle important public safety problems facing the state. Having experienced and fully staffed departments is critical when taking on crime, handling the prison population, or delivering emergency medical care. Dollars are crucial and they're being siphoned off as we are forced to deal with separations and an already difficult recruiting process made worse by our benefit package. This is why labor and management are united in our effort to pass HB 79. That brings me to Tier 4. I will spare the history and instead stick to the facts. On the pension side, Tier 4 provides a 5% 401A match, less than a Social Security contribution. It does not mandate Social Security or SBS, and it makes no distinction for public safety careers. You cannot find a plan like it anywhere in the country. I'm aware of three different sets of modeling on Tier 4 on how it would perform, and none would offer a glowing endorsement. Our actuary, who you'll hear from shortly, looked at it and he predicted 31% income replacement after a 25-year career. Department of Administration, Retirements and Benefits also did some modeling, and they predicted 38% after that 25-year career. Now, the difference is they put a finite set of time on the retirement, so if you outlived that time, you would be out of money. And last, Bob Mitchell, the CIO for the state, did some modeling, and while he did not look at a 25-year police officer or firefighter, he did look at a teacher with no SBS and no Social Security after a 30-year career, and there was a high likelihood that they ran out of money. Two things to note on the teacher: they get a higher contribution, and for a public safety individual to make 30 years, the average would be, they would be 61 years old at the end of that working in a public safety career. We've seen, I think we handed out the table of all the plans across the country for public safety in the book that we brought forward earlier this year to all legislators. You can't find another plan like Tier 4, and really no amount of education or salesmanship will change the reality that the referenced modeling has exposed. The described inadequacies lead us to our next set of problems, and that's the recruitment and retention of in-demand public safety professionals. Alaska is at a clear disadvantage in this process. Police officers and paramedics are in high demand across the nation. We must compete in the recruitment arena, and right now we are doing so with one hand tied behind our backs. Once Alaska agencies find an employee and invest time and money into it, there is a need to keep those employees and get a return on that investment. The troopers have listed $190,000 as the cost for training a new trooper. Over the last several years, we have heard from DPS, and they have described losing non-retirement eligible employees. Last year, they testified to the legislature that they lost 67 in the last 3 years alone. It's about $13 million walking out the door. Corrections provided similar testimony this year and talked about the hollowing out of their agency. I'm not here to say pension is the only factor, but it is no doubt a large one. If we look to the future, we can theorize about future problems. What will public safety agencies look like when they are staffed by an older workforce that lacks financial security to retire? Tier 4 is too new to see the results, but we are likely to see things like increased workers' comp. There's a study out of California on firefighters, and it clearly demonstrates that older firefighters get hurt more often, and they take longer to recover. With these problems in mind, we set out to find a solution that took into the considerations, the legitimate considerations of the state and also the real need for improvement. We started by looking at why certain plans got into trouble and why other plans avoided trouble. How did the most successful plans manage to stay that way? It was not about reinventing the wheel, it was about copying the best practices. Not all defined benefit plans are the same. Wisconsin and Washington are not Illinois or New Jersey. HB 79 does three things. It greatly reduces the benefits from tier three levels. It's built on more conservative assumptions. And lastly, it contains mechanisms to share risk and deal with adverse experience. So let me talk about the benefit reductions. The old tiers offered pre-Medicare health care. There is no prepaid Medicare health premiums under HB 79. Health care accounts for about 36% of the liability of the old legacy systems. And again, those pre-Medicare health premiums are off the table. Our health care coverage under this bill mirrors Tier 4, the HRA, and then post-Medicare secondary coverage. You must be 55 years old with 20 years of service to collect a benefit. The COLA benefit is removed. The final benefit is based on 5 years as opposed to three, and that's a larger, smoothing period. We then, as I said, built it off more conservative expectations and required steady, consistent fundings in good times and in bad. And lastly, we built in triggers to share risk. We allow for employee rates to adjust upward to 10%, but never go below 8%. And the post-retirement pension adjustment, which is the inflation proofing, can be withheld by the ARM board if the fund were to fall below 90%. This allows retirees, employees, active employees to share in the risk of the plan. When you couple all the benefit reductions with the best practices and triggers, you get a reasonable plan with reasonable risk, a plan that greatly reduces the risk through benefit reductions and more conservative estimates, and then has built-in mechanisms to share that risk. This is unlike any plan Alaska has seen. Alaska faces real problems related to recruitment and retention. It should not be shocking that employees are speaking with their feet. We are not exempt from the laws of economics. If you offer the most frugal plan in the nation, we should not be shocked that individuals with better options elect to act upon them. Sunk cost is a real cost. And when an individual is in a DB plan, they have the sunk cost of time. That is why we do not see Tier 3 members leaving at the pace of Tier 4. Let me close by saying it's totally appropriate for this committee to consider risk and cost. I only ask that both sides are measured. We have heard the testimony on recruitment and retention and seen the documents. What is the risk of maintaining the status quo? HB 79 has risk. Greatly reduced and shared, but still risk. We don't live in a riskless world. You can't walk across the street with absolute certainty. A police officer walking into a domestic disturbance faces risk. A corrections officer handling a violent criminal faces risk. A firefighter entering a burning structure faces risk. We measure it, and then we deal with it appropriately, and that is what we are asking the legislature to do. The problems are real. Management and labor are speaking with one voice on the issue. And HB 79 is the result of years of work. It's well thought out and well constructed plan that is built to address the problems Alaska faces. I look forward to addressing the committee's questions and concerns. And again, I thank you for taking the time to work on this important issue.
Thank you. Representative Kopp, do you have a PowerPoint presentation that you wanted to do? Do you want to do that before public testimony?
That would be a great, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Absolutely. And while they're putting that up with the committee, we have a pretty long sectional. Would it be okay with the committee that we, after the PowerPoint presentation, that we go ahead and go to public testimony? If we don't have time for the sectional today, when we bring it back, I just want to make sure we're not holding people online too long. Is that okay with the committee? Perfect. So with that.
Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chair. We have Flick Fornia, William Fornia, who is with Pension Trustee Advisors. You can see there he is a nationally renowned public safety pension expert, regularly gives testimony before the Congress House and Ways Committee on financial matters, and particularly public employee pension matters. He is online to talk us through his analysis of House Bill 79.
Mr. Fornia, could you please put yourself on the record and your affiliation, and then you may begin the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Kopp. Yes, I'm William Fornia. I'm an actuary with my own firm, Pension Trustee Advisors, and consultant to the firefighters and police on this matter. And I can't tell, is my slide deck showing, the cover slide?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. We now see the picture of you, so we know who we're talking to, so you may continue.
Oh wow, you went, so you moved ahead.
We did.
And by the way, I'm happy to take questions as we go along. And if we run out of time or choose to only go, you know, two-thirds of the way through this, you can consider the case studies as kind of supplemental material. So assuming you now have my picture, I'm a credentialed actuary. I'm on the board of directors of the Society of Actuaries. I was elected a couple of years ago. I speak a great deal. I've written several papers that are well documented. I've spoken to 11 state legislatures. I've been to you all in person a couple times and by phone maybe three or four times. I've also spoken to the legislatures in Illinois, Kentucky, Rhode Island, Ohio, Nebraska, Colorado, Utah, Oklahoma, New Mexico, and North Dakota. And let's move to the next slide, page 3, please. So some examples of the work I've done. I've worked both in the public and private sector. All of the last 20 years has been primarily in the public sector. I was first introduced to you all in 2005. I was hired. I'd been the leader of Buck Consultants Denver Retirement Practice. Then I joined the firm Gaber, Roeder & Smith and opened their Denver office. And one of our first major clients was the Onboard. And I believe GRS still does the work for them. They do an ongoing review. I don't know if you remember when Kathy testified on Monday, they talked about, you know, the arm reviewing actually was in the process of reviewing some numbers by Buck. That was my old firm. And then also I audited you all back in 2009. That was with a different firm. But I started my own individual consulting firm back in 2010, and then I was hired by the Public Pension Coalition in 2011, and I testified a couple times on that. I've been working with the police and the fire off and on ever since. I've consulted in 22 statewide retirement systems over the years, including being their actuary, so I basically have the same role that Buck has with you all in some of these other states. My largest client right now is the Ohio Retirement Study Council. They're an oversight board appointed by the Senate, the House, and the governor, and I meet with them regularly to kind of monitor all of their five pension systems. I've done a lot of expert testimony and consulting. I work for four different sides. I work for labor organizations, like I am now. I work for pension systems, such as PERS or Onboard. I work for governments, such as the Ohio City Council. And I've also worked for third parties. I was an expert witness in the Detroit bankruptcy and the Stockton bankruptcy when the creditors hired me to try to understand how that was working. Other clients included some cities, the U.S. Department of State, and then on the private sector side, IBM, Ford, and U.S. West. So if we can go to page 4, please.
Okay, before we go to page 4.
So basically I was asked to help analyze the tier 4 that you have right now for public safety.
Sir, we have a question.
I think.
Hello?
Yes, please.
So we have a question here, but first of all, are you on a speakerphone?
I'm on a headset, but it's not good enough. I'm happy to take it off and speak directly into the phone. That's better.
Yeah, if you could, we might be able to hear you better.
Or how about if I just speak up?
Okay, and you might need to take a breath once in a while because we're having we'll try to get our questions in. So, Representative Johnston.
Actuaries don't breathe.
I kind of figured that out. Representative Johnston has a question.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. As a regular expert witness in Detroit, Stockton, and Puerto Rico, have those been mainly as far as for labor groups or what type of pensions have you been looking at for those communities? Or what kind of expert witness have you been, is my question.
Did we lose him?
Are you still there?
He took off his headset.
Okay, we're going to take a quick at ease. We're back, and I'm going to try to explain what we were doing. Okay, so we happen to have Mr. Fournier. Are you back with us?
Yes, I am. I apologize. I think this was all my fault, trying to be clever with my headset.
No problem. Go ahead and give me the question.
Shall I continue, Madam Chair?
No, we have a question, so she's going to ask it again because you were probably disconnected at the time. Representative Johnston.
Through the chair. I see that you put down that you're a regular expert witness, and it was for Detroit, Stockton, and Puerto Rico. And I'm curious what kind of those three communities, as you know, have some interesting pension history.
Yes, they do. They've been very, very interesting. So for Detroit, I was hired by the banks in Europe that loaned a bunch of money to the city. They were called pension obligation bonds, and they put them into the pension fund, and then the city went bankrupt, and they weren't getting very much of their money back, and they wanted to understand all the ramifications, and I testified in federal bankruptcy court on that. My client didn't do very well because Detroit was bankrupt. They only got, I think, 14 or 18 cents on the dollar, but my role was to help advise them on, you know, where they could push back on different items. The city of Stockton, California was a couple of years earlier. I don't know if you recall, but they were also in bankruptcy. They were the first large city to go bankrupt. And there I was hired by the bond insurers. So the municipal bonds were insured, and their bond insurer wanted to, you know, protect what they were insuring. And so very similar to Detroit, I advised them on the issues. And California, as you may know, has some very complex rules on pension protection and those kinds of things. So I helped educate them there. I think I was deposed. I don't remember if I actually testified at trial on that. Puerto Rico, just coincidentally, I started working for them in 2008, and I worked for the pension fund, so that'd be like if I was working for PERS. Then I was with a larger firm then. Then when I started my own firm, they hired me. I was on the governor's commission for pension reform. I was hired, did small projects off and on for them. You know, they're terribly poorly funded, and they're in a very difficult financial situation, too. I was hired by the governor in 2016, I believe. Then the governor changed, and then I was hired by the Oversight Board, which is like the board that the federal government appointed back in 2016, and I worked for them through the end of last year. So I'm not working with Puerto Rico anymore. But you're right, I've had some very intriguing and challenging clients, that's for sure. Was that an adequate answer?
Thank you.
I see no further questions. We are on page 4.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So I think Tom talked a little bit about why change is necessary. I've got some numbers to back this up. Tom talked a little bit about how we're proposing to structure this new program that we're calling the Public Safety Pension Fix. And then I have illustrations of some projections of what might happen in the future. And I'll move quickly through this. So on page 5, basically the column in the middle is a typical police and firefighter. On the average, they're hired at 31. If they work 25 years, they'd retire at 56. Under the Tier 3, they'd have a formula of basically 57% of final average pay. But we calculated under Tier 4, you know, the DCR tier, based on, you know, their money going in and certain returns and certain life expectancy, they would only be able to pay themselves 31% of pay throughout their lifetime. Mr. Westcott mentioned that another study had shown 38%. That's probably because they did some modeling slightly different. But the bottom line is you can't retire on that. You know, you don't get Social Security. And let's look at page 6. Page 6 just shows this in a chart. You know, for this hypothetical police or firefighter that had 25 years, under Tier 3, they would have gotten, you know, 57% of pay, which is about $46,000. You know, that can make it. But under Tier 4, they get only $25,000. And even if they only got Social Security, which they don't get, but even if they were just, you know, some other private sector worker, they would get $21,000. So what they're getting out of Tier 4 is barely as good as Social Security. You know, this is not just a communication problem. This is a fundamental weakness of this Tier 4. Page 7. So this is just some general pros and cons or strengths and weaknesses of the two kinds of plans. I assume you all know DB is a defined benefit plan similar to your Tiers 1, 2, and 3. DC is a defined contribution plan similar to a 401k or your Tier 4. So DB plans are more cost effective because what happens is that they pool what's called the longevity risk, the risk of living too long. Under DC plan, if you die like a year or two after you retire, you've done better than you would have if you were under a DB plan. But under a DC plan, if you die, you know, later than the actuarial average, you do worse. So what the DB plan does, and PERS and TERS and their actuaries are very good at predicting how long the people live on the average, and they fund for just that. They don't fund to give large bequests to people that die shortly after they retire. DC, because of the way they're structured, they have to do it that way. Second advantage of DB plans is their portfolio of investments can stay diversified their whole career. And then that gives them higher returns. They don't need to scale down to a more conservative investment as they get older. Like you've got your target date fund in the DC plans. The DB doesn't have to do target date funds. They can do the best mix for everybody because they've got the value of time. And then DB plans just generally are better managed. They have lower fees than DC plans. But then DC plans have some strengths because they're consistent with the whole idea of individual responsibility. You know, it's very clear what your employer is giving you in a DC plan. They're giving you 5% of pay, you know, and you get to put it in a pension fund and you get to invest it and so on. It's much more under your control. You know, you can decide when you want to retire. You can, you know, switch the assets around. If you change jobs, you can take it with you. It's easier than DB plan. So those are the advantages to the employees of DC plans. And then the one that I heard a lot about when I listened to Monday's testimony is the unfunded liability risk. If under a DC plan, there's no risk of the employer ever having an unfunded liability. Now, what that means is that, you know, if you have bad returns and you'd had a DB plan, the employer's got to fund more. If you'd had bad returns and you have a DC plan, the employee has to figure out how to make it work. So there's still an unfunded liability. It's just shifted to the employee that thought they could retire at 55 or 59 can't. So, you know, the math is basically the same. It's just how it gets transmitted. And then DB plans, the one we've structured here is, and I'll get to this quite a bit in the next few slides, is designed to take this risk that the state has borne on your old plans, your legacy plans, and try to scrap it so that there's less likelihood of that happening to the new DEB, this new PSF or DB plan, until we have some discussion on how we'll do that.
So who else has this plan? What other states have the kind of plan that you're putting forth today?
Well, Madam Chair, through the chair, every state has a different plan. I've got four examples in the back of states that have similar, I guess you could call this a cost-sharing plan, where if costs are increased, it shifts to the employees instead of just the employer. But every state has a completely different structured plan. This particular example, I'll have to think. I don't think there's anything that, South Dakota has some very similar features where the cost of living adjustment is suspended if the plan is poorly funded. Wisconsin has some similar features. Nobody has something identical to this. And I think, we could certainly craft something that's identical to Wisconsin or identical to Colorado Fire and Police or any number of other plans that are effectively shifting risk. But this is the one that is in the current bill.
So Wisconsin that you're speaking of, how long has their plan been in place?
Oh, no, it's not in place at all. The legislation is to put it in place.
So let me ask the question again. So is there anyone who has a similar plan? It doesn't have to be exactly the same. Currently in place?
Yes. Okay. Similar plans, I would say, would be South Dakota, Wisconsin, Colorado, Fire and Police. You'll hear from Steve Nelson at Washington State Law Enforcement Retirement. They have some very similar features. Washington State's been about 20 years. Colorado's been since 78, I think. So this is a kind of a newer type of design. None of these plans have been around for decades. Although Wisconsin put in the Wisconsin plan's been around for probably since the 20s or 30s. I believe they put these features in about 20 years ago. Wisconsin's a great example because they weathered the market crash, the 2008 market crash. Basically employees didn't get a cost of living adjustment for a couple of years. And it worked exactly like they hoped, where, it helped them get back to nearly 100% funded. South Dakota has, I think, had these features for maybe about 10 or 15 years. But that plan's been around since, I think, the 60s or maybe the 50s. But they're a young state, kind of like you.
Okay, so I'm just trying. Wait a minute. We don't need a whole history of every state. I appreciate that you're trying to educate us a lot. But when I asked about Wisconsin, your comment was they don't have it yet, and now you're going back to Wisconsin. And not that I don't want to. My son lives there, so it would be a great place to go back to. So Wisconsin does have a plan similar to what we're proposing.
Madam Chair, I think I misunderstood your question. I thought when you asked how long has this plan been in place, you meant this plan, the HB 79 plan. No, the Wisconsin plan has been in place for decades and decades, and this feature has been in place at least since the early 90s when I was first made aware of it.
And do they have any kind of unfunded liability at this point?
If so, it's less than 5%. I don't have the numbers in front of me.
Well,
we can certainly get back to you on that.
What would less than 5% mean? I mean, they probably have...
That means they're like 95% funded or better. I can double check.
Okay.
I don't recall their funded level off the top of it. But they're very, they're very secure in terms... Their contributions are stable. And, so even though they might be below... As Madam Chair, as you'll see in my slide, any plan will float above and below 100%. The key is we're trying to build it so that it stays above, and if it does go below significantly, we take action. It's just like when I'm saving for my retirement. Now, I'm in a 401k, and so I'm 60 years old, so 10 years ago I was 50, the market tanked. And so basically my unfunded liability became huge. My shortfall for my personal retirement saving became huge. Well, luckily I had more than 10 years to make up for it, and so any kind of financial arrangement where it's invested in risky assets is going to have good years and bad years. The trick is to take action in the bad years and don't get too complacent in the good years. And Wisconsin has done a good job of that.
You may continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on page 8, basically, What your proposed program does is it has a fixed employer contribution and then tries to manage that as much as possible. Manage the plan by adjusting benefits if necessary and adjusting the employee and possibly employer contribution. We've designed the current target benefits, and they're somewhat similar to the tier three, but they're reduced. You'll see some examples in a minute. We build in mechanisms to adjust if experience is bad. And then this last bullet, so when the actuary measures the unfunded liability, the actuary uses an assumed rate of investment return. And one of the knocks against defined benefit plans, public sector, is that the actuaries have been too optimistic in terms of the returns. As you remember from your presentation on Monday, PERS and Team PERS used to use an 8.25% investment return, and they're lowering it to, they lowered it to 8, and now they're proposing lowering it again to 7.38. We've built this one based on 7. So we wanted to have a little cushion. So when we take action at a 90% funded level, you know, that's based on a 7% rate of return, whereas you know, that might really only be, it might be more like 94% funded using the higher rate of return. So we felt it was important to, you know, bite the bullet, use a conservative assumed rate of return, so that we've got a little more cushion against adverse experience.
So could you tell us that, so it takes 12% fixed employer contribution in Tier 4. Do you know what the fixed employer contribution is for the state of Alaska?
Well, the employer contribution is 22%. And right now, only 5 of that is going towards Tier 4 employees, and the rest is going to pay off the unfunded liability.
So, Representative
Trump, this would bump that amount to this new fund to 12%.
I'm going to call in at ease. You know, we have to be able to the record, just to share some information, we have a lot of pension plans right now. So we have Tier 1, 2, and 3, which we're not going to get into those details because I am not an expert on any of those. But Tier 4 is the current plan that if you were to come into the state of Alaska as a new employee, not as somebody who'd been working in government in some other fashion, you would be in Tier 4. HB 79 is before us because this would be basically a pilot project that would change what we do in Tier 4 to this new hybrid plan. Let me just verify before we get the answer to the question that we asked. Ms. Lee, are you online?
Ms. William Forney, I'm online, but I keep getting music coming through.
Okay. Well, we're asking
Can you all hear me, Madam Chair?
Yeah, we can hear you, but we're wanting to know if retirement benefits, Ms. Lee is online because we want to make sure that she can.
She's away from her desk.
Oh. Okay, Ms. Lee, you have music in the background. We're going to try to fix that. Okay, but until then, the question is, it says 12% fixed employer contribution. My question was, this new plan would be 12% for the employer contribution. How does that compare to the employer contribution for Tier 4? Whoever wants
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that a question for me?
No, we have somebody in the room who wants to take a shot at it first.
Madam Chair, for the record, Tom Westcott. The roughly Tier 4 costs about 8 to 8.5%. So the difference is 3.5%.
Okay, perfect. And did we get Ms. Lee, are you on?
Yes, I am.
Thank you.
Yes, I am.
Thank you, Ms. Lee, and we can hear you. So I just have a question for you is, as we're going through this presentation and we're trying to do as much of a side-by-side as we can between Tier 4 and this particular plan, we heard a little bit about that Tier 4 gives funds to the other tiers because of the liability we have. If we were to change into this pilot project, would these individuals be giving that same percentage of their pay as we do those that are in Tier 4?
Well, to clarify, the Tier 4 members don't put anything towards the unfunded liability of the other tiers. The employer pays 5% for their contributions. Then they pay additional contributions for the retiring medical plan, the occupational death and disability plan, and the health reimbursement arrangement plan. The health reimbursement arrangement is a flat dollar amount. The other contributions come up to a total of 6.70%. So as Mr. Westcott said, it's approximately 8% that the employer puts in. But employers are required on the employer contribution side to pay 22%. So anything over what is required for the DCR plan is used to pay down the unfunded liability. Under this new legislation, there is actually an exclusion for that, so there would be less money going towards the unfunded liability because this group would not be required to pay that. So the employer would not be required to pay that.
And can you put yourself on the record in your affiliation?
I'm sorry. For the record, this is Kathy Lee. I'm the Chief Pension Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits.
Perfect. And I thank you for the clarification. There's a lot of numbers going around. Representative Johnston.
Thank you, through the chair. So you're saying with this pilot program, employers would not count these employees in their employee numbers as far as paying their participation to the pension fund for the unfunded liability. Is that correct?
Ms. Lee.
That's correct. This group would, under the current legislation, this group would pay only their employer contribution, which is around 12%, and there would be no additional that would go to the unfunded liability.
Follow-up? So I'm looking at the fiscal note here. Is that how the fiscal note, how you addressed it in the fiscal note?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, we have not submitted an actuarial fiscal note yet. The only fiscal note that we have submitted is the administrative fiscal note. We got word from our actuaries today that it may take them about two more weeks to complete the actuarial fiscal note. Due to the recent changes the Alaska Retirement Management Board has made to the assumptions for valuation.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 16 of the bill makes it explicitly clear on lines 20 and 21 that the funds, the increased contribution rates, are there to reduce the accrued actuarial liability. And Mr. Westcott just pointed out to me that the contribution rate is set up to 12% by the ARM board, and whatever the required or the funding amount is that's less than that that's actually needed would go to reduce the whole system liability. Is that correct, Westcott?
For the record, Tom Westcott, Alaska Professional Firefighters. The intention and what our bill set out to do was to still collect 22% from the employers to go to PERS, with 12 of it going towards our plan and the remaining going towards the unfunded liability. That's in the charts. I believe it's in the legislation, but if it's not, it's a mistake. The intent was to maintain 22% with a portion going to our bill and the other portion continuing to go towards the unfunded liability.
And we will have that checked, and we appreciate that. Representative Johnston, followed by Representative Josephson.
So just to follow up on that, it would be basically a discounted rate for your employees, where other employees, the employer cost would go to maybe not as much of a reimbursement to the employer's plan as they did to yours, but you would still be taking the difference from your 12% to the 22% for the employers. So it would be a segregated population treated a little bit differently, but you would at least go up to the 22%, correct? I mean, the employers would be paying. So the employer's amount would not change at all until Buck said that there's an additional cost for less contribution, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I think you're correct. Yes, that it would just be a little more money going for public safety.
Thank you.
And we'll go back to retirement benefits and see if we can't get an analysis of some kind of side-by-side to make sure we're not missing anything, since it sounds it might be a couple of weeks before we get the actuary to the committee. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, is this new Tier 5, is this for a prospective, or would Tier 4 be able to buy into this?
Madam Chair, Representative Josephson, Tier 4 people would have an option to buy in. It may not be a direct, time for service to time for service. There probably would have to be buy-in, which is why we think it'll only be a subset of employees that are eligible that will actually do this. It'd be more attractive to the newly hireds, the 0 to 5 years, than people that have 10, 11 years in.
And
Madam Chair, Representative Kopp, the slide 12 shows how that would work.
And one more question from Ms. Lee. When we get the actuary, will it show us some of the concerns that we had at our presentation on how this might play out 10, 15, 20 years from now?
Madam Chair, the actuary will show what will occur over the next 5 fiscal years. It will not go past that period of time.
Okay, we'll have to deal with that at that time. It's concerning, but maybe we can. Okay, I'm going to ask the obvious question, why? I mean, why can't we go out further? I mean, is that because we just didn't ask, or?
Madam Chair, we can request that they go out a little further. That I believe they're comfortable with going out about 10 years. But past that length, they're not comfortable in trying to estimate what the liability might be, because we will have had two more periods where the assumptions will be reviewed for the valuation and may change in that 10-year period.
And understandable. And 10 years would be great because from, you know, presentation, it sounded like it would be at least 10 years if we had an issue before we would see one. So that would at least give us, you know, somewhat of an indication better than 5 years would. So that would be great if you could do that. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So for the first 10 years, we're not going to be looking at people retiring if we're targeting new employees into the system. So the only thing that we really need to worry about is what is the unfunded liability that's coming in after 10 years when people start drawing from the benefit. I don't really care what happens between now and 10. I want to know when they start drawing. If I'm going to add a defined benefit plan that puts me in an unfunded liability in years 12 or 11 through 20 or however long, that's what I need to know about.
So Ms. Lee, correct us if we're wrong. So if the 10 years just shows us the money being put in but no money going out, how do we prevent, you know, something from happening if we don't know when an unfunded, if one would exist? I guess we don't understand why you're doing an actuary. Ms. Lee, could you tell us why we do an actuary that would show 10 years if that's really not going to give us an indication whether or not we're going to end up in the same issues we have with our other pension plans?
Well, Madam Chair, 10 years is about as comfortable as the plan actuary is in forecasting what a liability might look at. We can ask them to give us an opinion on how the levers in this bill will address any unfunded liability that may occur.
Okay, so is Representative Carpenter correct in his analysis when he says that 10 years really won't show us anything unless people buy in, of course, but if we're basically doing this for new employees and they have to work for at least 20 years, is that correct, Representative Kopp?
20 years to get your benefit at 55 or be 60 years and have at least invested the minimum amount of time of 5 years of service.
Okay, so we might see a few that might be in there, but the majority of those is going to be most likely 20 years before we see that. Is there no way for us to get that type of analysis, Ms. Lee?
I don't believe there is because there is really no real data for them to look at, but we can ask them for their opinion on how this new plan will address ongoing liability past the 10-year period. Because this bill does have some levers in it to adjust contribution rates and to adjust cost of living rates if the funding is impaired. So we can ask them to give us their opinion on that.
We'd appreciate that. Representative Kopp.
Madam Chair, may I respond?
Representative Kopp says that you can respond, so yes, you may.
Thank you. The unfunded liability is a projection of future benefits. So you'll know a lot of information in 10 years. Just because no one's retired yet doesn't mean that the plan will be either overfunded or underfunded. You know, you're funding, you're putting contributions in for 10 years, the investment return will be either higher or lower than expected. Your pay raises will be higher or lower than expected. So the actuary, whenever they do the measurement, they measure all future anticipated events. So just because you don't have anyone retiring yet doesn't mean that you won't be either in a surplus situation or an underfunded situation. So while Buck would only be projecting the fiscal impact for the next 5 years, I would encourage them to review the projections we did, and they could, you know, push back on some of the assumptions we took or make some comments, because we've shown, you know, there's a pretty small likelihood that after 20 years or more, that the plan would be significantly underfunded. And as someone said earlier, if it is, we'll have had, you know, 10 or 20 years to react. You know, this is a great example. You know, you put in the DCR 15 or 12 years ago, and now because of certain limitations, you're reviewing this. I would imagine that if things are really good or things are really bad in 12, 15 years, you will be taking some kind of action. But we still want to do a forecast of, you know, out into the future. So I think you'll get very valuable information from Buck. I look forward to reviewing it, and I encourage them to review our projections too, so that we're not arguing over what the actuary says. We're arguing over the actual contents of the legislation.
Well, we will absolutely make that request, but you also have to understand that we are at a $300 million right now, soon to be $500 million in the next couple of years. We need to make sure that we're treading carefully, because I don't want to find out that in 15 or 20 years that we got ourselves into the same bind we did before, which is not my understanding the bill does, but I just, you know, it's not an easy decision as we ended up in this issue for a lot of different reasons. Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and your caution is well taken. I fully support it. That's that, of course, that unaccrued liability is spread out over across all state employees. We're looking at a pool of employees rather than the 30 and 40,000 of about 1,700 that would probably actually be in this. If we ever had a small sample size for a pilot project to prove a model, this is it.
But I'm pretty sure they're not the only ones who might want to be in this eventually, so.
Yes, Madam Chair, I agree, but we have to prove it can work first.
We're very curious, but we tread carefully here. So, Mr. Fornia, I think we are on page 9.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Page 9 is just a comparison of the three plans, and as you can see on the right-hand column, the employer contribution, the objective is, you know, in Section 17, the 22% contribution will be made, and it could, and 12, 13, or 14% will go towards this plan. The other provisions are fairly similar. The retirement age, the big change here is retirement age under Tier 3. You can retire at any age as long as you have 20 years in. We would put in an age 55 requirement. That gets the cost down a little bit. The benefit multipliers are the same. The final average pay under Tier 3, you average the highest 3 years of pay. Now we would average the highest 5 years of pay. This brings down the benefit to slightly more, to a few percent. The Alaska COLA is a 10% increase, basically. That would go away. So the idea here is we put in these provisions so that the benefits would be a little bit lower, or we put in triggers, and those we show on slide 10. As Tom mentioned, you have a post-retirement pension adjustment, kind of to adjust for inflation, and that's automatic now. In this new plan, it would only be given if the plan was well-funded at 90% or better. The medical coverage, we basically wouldn't make any change to the medical coverage. So these people would have the same medical as Tier 4. Disability essentially is the same also. That's on page 10. So we built in these modifications to kind of get the plan more bulletproof, I guess you could say, so there's less chance of being in a bad situation like you found yourself in with the other plans.
So can you explain the disability?
Page 11.
Can you explain the disability portion of it?
It's basically some of the same points I just made. So why don't I move? Well, maybe not. The third bullet. So when you hit this trigger, if you hit it, of 90% funded, the employee contribution is going to ratchet up. So the ARM board will have discretion to have the employees increase their contributions. Instead of 8%, go up to as much as 10%.
Okay, so we're going to go back to page 10. Okay, back to 10. Also on disability, you said it was the same as Tier 4, but your slide says same as Tier 3. So is that a misprint on the public safety fix? Should that have said same as Tier 4?
I'm sorry. Tier 4 and Tier 3 are very similar.
No.
The occupational disability is, you know, between Tier 3 and Tier. Basically, on Tier 4, you replace the disability from Tier 3 with just some minor changes. I don't recall. The cost differential would be pretty small. I believe it's the same as Tier 4. We can confirm that.
Okay. Well, we have somebody here who wants to confirm it. No, we have somebody right now in the room that's going to confirm exactly what the difference is on the disability.
Madam Chair, Tom Westcott, Alaska Professional Firefighters, and we just had an individual go through this. They are similar. Tier 4 provides you an option of reverting back to Tier 3 and getting the 40%. Then the employer still makes the contribution. Originally, when it was being considered, there was no death and disability, and that was a sticking point for public safety, and they, in the effort to pass the legislation and switch, they just said, we'll get you have the option to go back to and basically get the Tier 3 coverage. So you could get a 40% disability, just like Tier 3, under Tier 4, or you could choose to, and then when you reach normal retirement age, which would be 25 years of service. You have the choice to continue the 40% or take what is accumulated in your Tier 4 account.
And that's current?
That's currently how Tier 4 works.
So do people, so does someone buy into Tier 3? Is that what they do on the disability if they want to?
No, a portion, as Ms. Lee pointed out, of the when she was saying what Tier 4 costs, a portion of that is to pay for death and disability benefits.
Thank you. Ms. Fornian, you may continue on page 11.
Thank you. Wynn, why don't we go ahead and move to page 12. I've covered the page 11 pretty well. And I believe one of the representatives asked a question about this a few minutes ago. The idea is that we don't want to create an unfunded liability if we let anyone transfer into the plan. So the onboard will make actuarially equivalent calculations for how much it costs for someone to purchase some of their time into this new plan. They'll have 90 days to make the decision, and they can use their Tier 4 account to purchase this service credit. Or they can keep their Tier 4 account and start with no service in the new plan. For example, if they don't have enough, let's say they've worked there 6 years, they've only got $100,000 in their Tier 4, and the calculation determines that it costs $120,000 to buy 6 whole years of service, they could elect to either purchase only 5 years with $100,000 or find a way to come up with $20,000 so they can get the full 6 years. And so everyone will start off with zero unfunded liability because the fund will get the assets equal to the liability that's created. And the onboard will make those determinations, those actuarial calculations. Page 13 is some detail on specific calculations. I'm happy to go through this, or if in the interest of time, you might prefer to move forward. The key points here are, so the left-hand side is Tier 3, the right-hand side is Tier 5. You know, the average salary is a little bit lower in Tier 5 because you're using 5 years instead of 3. The COLA is non-existent in Tier 5. The average salary then makes the benefit lower. So you have a $14 benefit in Tier 3, but it would only be $4,579 in Tier 5. You'd have no COLA on there, and your CPI adjustment would only apply if the plan's well funded. Your health care would be based on the current 3% HRA contribution, which is what you have now under Tier 4. Page 14 is a few other key points. So in this case, the Tier 3 person would have had a pension benefit of $56,000 with another $5,600 COLA and then $19,000 in medical, but the Tier 5 person would only have the $54,000 pension plus whatever they built in their medical account. So what we're trying to show here is the benefits are not nearly as generous as the Tier 3 benefits are. The other thing is that you can't get the benefit
right now,
until age 55, whereas Tier 3, you could have some police officers, firefighters that have 20 years on and start collecting it, I guess it could be even like 45 if they're young enough.
We have a question. Yeah, we have a question from Representative Carpenter, and I just want to make sure that we make this clear. Tier 3 is not currently, even though this is a comparison, Tier 3 is not available at this time. People are coming in on Tier 4. So, this kind of gets confusing, so I want to make sure that individuals are watching that. This is between Tier 4 and possibly what would be classified as a new Tier 5. So, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, thank you. The key here is we're trying to show that Tier 3 has gotten into a little bit of trouble. Tier 5 is designed to not get into trouble, and these are some of the things that we've changed. We're not just suggesting going back to Tier 3. We're coming up with a kind of a stripped-down Tier 3, which we're calling Tier 5 or public safety fix. But that's an excellent point.
Now we have a question from Representative Carpenter.
I think my question is for Ms. Lee, potentially. Is the $95,000 final five high average salary an accurate number for our folks in Alaska? I'm not sure where these numbers are coming from. So is this plausible for Alaska?
Ms. Lee.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, at the end of a career, that is a reasonable high three average or high five average.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, so it looks like we are on page 15.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Page 15. So we put in what we're calling these safeguards. And the first one is the one I've been focusing on in the last few minutes, which is the benefits. So this is a safeguard for Tier 5 vis-a-vis Tier 3 or versus Tier 3. We put in these safeguards. You got to be at least 55. You're using a five-year average salary instead. You don't get the Alaska COLA. We'll suspend the pension adjustment if they're not well-funded. And then if you're poorly funded, we'll also increase the employer and employee contributions. So the whole idea of this is to try to do what we can to keep an unfunded liability from existing or growing. Tier 6, page 16 is a lot of numbers, and I maybe the middle, it shows that, so I tried to, and I would love it if Buck would bet these numbers, and I think they should be close, but to do the modeling, we tried to modify, figure out what Tier 5 would cost, and we know that Tier 3, based on Buck's 8% return, costs 17.3% of pay for their defined benefit features. We wanted to be conservative, so we're using the middle column instead. We're lowering the assumed rate of return. We're lowering the inflation, just like Buck is proposing. And then, so we think the cost would go up when Buck changes the assumptions, but we're taking out some benefits. We're taking out the age, we're putting in a 55 requirement. That saves us 1%. We're changing the earnings period to 5 years. That saves us 0.7%. We're getting rid of the Alaska COLA. That saves us another 0.7%. And then if we're underfunded, we won't pay the post-retirement pension adjustment. And if we're underfunded, we'll increase the contributions by 4%. So this gets the cost to the pension benefit down to 15.7%, but we're putting in 16.9% after the health care. So we've got this 1.2% margin already, you know, if things are normal, but we have an additional margin for adverse experience. So the whole idea is we want to have margins in here. In the past, with your legacy plans, you didn't have a margin. You know, when things went south, you just had to pay more or else not pay more. But you were supposed to pay more. You know, the actuary made a calculation, your cost would go up. We now have margins in here, and as we'll see in the projections, the idea for that is to minimize the downside risk. I'm on page 17 now. I mentioned the margin a little bit, that margin builds in reserves in the good times and even the neutral times. And hopefully those reserves will be helpful if the bad times hit. The bottom bullets of page 17 just restate what we showed in page 16, so I won't go through those unless someone has a question. And then page 18 is our reduced discount rate. So, again, we wanted to make sure this was being structured on a conservative basis. You know, historically, you would use as high as 8.25% assumed rate of return. It's been dropped to 8. Recently, Armboard or PERS or both have approved the actuary's recommendation to lower that to 7.38. And we went lower still. We said we want to build this around a 7% discount rate. So we've got even more margin for better funding. And that's the whole idea. We want to commit to 12% employer contributions, possibly a couple percent more if things are bad, 8 to 10% for the employees. And as we go forward, we will adjust benefits downward, not upward, but downward, if things are necessary, if we hit a 90% funded level. So starting with page 19, we did a bunch of simulations. The first simulation we did, and this is pretty similar to what Buck will do when they do their fiscal note, is we'll say, well, what if we hit the returns that we think we're going to hit? The ARM board investment consultants have said that they think we're only going to get about 6.6% return in the next 10 years because interest rates are so low right now. There's some losses in the bond markets possibly. And then Buck assumes we'll get 7.38 in the long run. So we did some projections, put those numbers in, and we found that the plan, of course, if you hit your target, it will never fall below 100%. It would just drift up, and eventually it would be, after 20 years, the funded level would hit 107%. Then the next thing we did, and I'm on page 20 now, is we back-tested it. So remember when PERS was giving the presentation, or Kathy rather was giving the presentation on Monday, they showed these historical returns that PERS had received, earned over a period of time. We got those historical returns, and what we tried to figure out is, well, what if we put this plan in 1980? Or what if we put that in 1998 and ran it for 20 years? I'm sorry, there's a typo. The second bullet should say 1998 to 2018. In other words, the idea is if we go back in history and say this is the return we would have had for 20 years, how would we look? And what we did is, you know, we were able to get the historical returns, and the next page kind of shows that. Why don't you flip to page 21, rather, that has the three lines. Basically, what the orange line is was like your average, the median. That was if we started the plan in 1994 and looked again in 20 years at 2004. That was the average case, the median case, rather. There were, you know, 9 cases that were better than that, 9 cases that were worse than that. And if that had happened, you would have followed this orange line. You would have looked really good for a few years. You know, I guess, what did I say? This started in 1994. Yeah, so you would have started when the market was going great in the 90s. You would have been up to 130% funded after about year 6. This is the orange line. But then you would have fallen. The market crash would have hit you in year 14. The 2008 crash, you would have fallen down a little bit, and then you would have drifted down, and you'd be right around 100% funded right now. That's the average case. Now, the gray is your worst case. We took the worst of all 20-year periods that started back in 1980 that we had data for. The worst case is if you started the plan, like, towards the end of the bull market in 1998. If you started the plan then, you would have had the dot-com bubble burst in year 3. You would have gotten down to almost 90% funded, but you would have drifted back up. You would have been at 100% funded. Then the 2007-2008 crash would have hit, and you would have been down right around 90% funded. You would have done some asset smoothing, and it would have, a couple of years later, in year 14, you would have been under the 90%. You would have activated the triggers. You would have suspended the cost of the inflation. Now, you've only been around for 14 years, so you wouldn't have that much power by suspending that inflation. But your employees would start to contribute an extra 0.5%, and it would, every year we'd bump that employee contribution rate up a little bit. And sure enough, you would have recovered and been at 100% by year 20, which in this case would have been 2018 was year 20. So that's the worst case. The worst case out of all 19 that we simulated, we would have hit the trigger for a couple of years and been back at 100%. Now, the yellow line, which is the one I hope we get, is what I call the 75th percentile best case. So out of all 19 cases, this is like the fourth from the top, fourth from the best. And this one you would have started in 1985. If you started in 1985, you would have had a little bit of money in. You would have ridden the 1990s bull market for a while. By year 15, which is 2000, you would have been 160% funded. So your consultants would be coming in telling you how great you were. Then the dot-com bubble would have burst, and you would have fallen down to about 125% funded. So that was one of the best, better cases. The thing we're trying to illustrate here is that in the real world, you will have returns that look like this. Your funded ratio, if I come back in 20 years, we will have a chart that looks like one of these three lines, or it'll be a wiggling line. It won't be a straight line. And that's what we're trying to do, is craft a plan where the bottom part of the wiggly lines are not too bad. And we're trying to show that on slide 22 through 25. At this point, maybe I should take a breath and see if there's a question from anyone through slides 21.
And we have a question from Representative Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair. So, Mr. Fornia, it looks like there's actually, in a sense, there's two triggers. There's the trigger which would suspend the COLA, and there's a second trigger which would require a greater contribution from the member. Is that right?
Yeah, almost. There's actually one trigger that fires three guns. It suspends the COLA. The way we modeled this, let me back up. The legislation gives the ARM board discretion on what to do between three different levers. One is to suspend the COLA, but the post-retirement pension adjustment, the inflation adjustment. Mm-hmm. One is to bump up the employee contribution by up to 2%, and one is to bump up the employer contribution by up to 2%. The way we model this is whenever you, if you're below 90, we'll suspend the COLA for sure, and then we'll bump up the contribution by 0.5% each year that you continue to be under 90. So in this case, this gray line case, it looks like I can't tell if they hit the line in year 11, but let's say they didn't hit it till year 13. The employee contributions would have gone to 8.5. The employers would have gone to 12.5. Then year 14, you're still below, would have gone up another half. Year 15, you're still below. And then so you're going to be putting in an extra 1.5% of pay. And then once it gets above 100, we take it back. Okay, so that's the way these triggers would work. But the ARM board will have discretion. You know, we don't know what they'll decide to do in year 11, you know, when this happens. But they know they've got these three levers they can activate.
Okay. Follow up.
So, fundamentally, the main two savings, along with the triggers that you mentioned, are the plan does not provide health care between age 55 and 65, and it also requires a postponement of retirement by some measure. Those are the main features that get you to a place where you're performing so well in these models. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd say so. If you remember that chart we had, yeah, the Alaska COLA also is helpful, you know, the no Alaska COLA. And then the final pay is a little bit helpful, the longer final averaging period. But having to wait until you've got age 55, you know, for your younger hires, that's a big deal. You know, if someone's hires at 25 and under the old plan, they could have retired at 45, but now we make them wait till 55, that saves a ton of money. You know, it doesn't save any money for the person that is hired at 35, but that definitely saves money. So we wanted to strip down the plan a little bit, still make it, you know, valuable to the public safety workers, and then put in triggers if things don't go as well as we are expecting.
Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
The triggers, thank you, Madam Chair, the triggers that you're talking about, are those automatic triggers, or are those triggers that must be, that come from some board decision?
Through the chair, yeah, the way the legislation is drafted, it's an ARM board decision on whether to activate the triggers. In my simulations, I've assumed that they would activate the triggers in terms of the inflation adjustment suspension and then gradual increases in the contributions. So what's going to happen if this legislation passes is that as you get near that, your actuary will do projections just like this. And they'll tell the ARM board, look, you know, if you don't activate this trigger, you've got much bigger chance of being in more trouble. If you activate it fully, you've got less. And then they'll make the decision. You know, maybe it's in a year that they gave no raises. So maybe they don't want to have the employee contribution go up. I mean, it could, you know, the idea is to have some discretion, but definitely, you know, some parameters around which they can act.
Yeah, follow up. So our current pension plans, I imagine the legislature went through a similar process to, I can't believe that the sales pitch then would be, we'd be in a $500 million unfunded liability. Otherwise, the legislature probably wouldn't have picked that plan. So I wonder, when is it that we have to put our $3 billion in to keep this plan afloat? Because I'm sure they didn't project that back then. I don't get it.
Is that a question you'd like to answer by anybody? Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry, through the chair, I don't know the history of the decisions you all made either in 2005 or 1998. I would imagine that there were somewhat similar projections that in 2005 caused you to, you know, completely change from to DC program. And then, and I'm not sure about how you made your decisions in 1998, but those were the major, you know, dates that you made these big decisions.
Thank you. Well, we all were here in 1998, and you just proved our point on why we're very cautious about the program, because you're probably right. They had graphs like this, and it didn't turn out that way. We're going to let Representative Kopp answer first, and then we'll go to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I was acting manager of the City of Kenai during some of this time period, and I can tell you we had passive management of the trust. We did not do active audits. And as you recall, we ended up suing our actuary, who gave us bad information and left us in terrible trouble. We got bad advice, and that has since resolved. We have new actuaries now, but the state of Alaska learned a lot of lessons.
Representative Johnston.
He answered it pretty well. It was a huge actuarial issue, and also, there were many different funds that went into the one fund. Some were well funded, some weren't, and they couldn't sort it all out, so they were all thrown into one basket.
There were many problems, which hopefully won't happen. Representative Josephson, also a helpful committee.
And along with those comments and successful litigation, never as much as what we asked for, I think the bill sort of explains the answer. That is, it postpones retirement considerably, and it deprives the person of not having the medical benefit, which I do want to hear about. I want to hear about how that would be covered during that 10-plus year span. And then we've got these triggers and adjustments, which strike me, and so I will ask a question about that. I haven't seen this before, where an employee is asked after retirement to make adjustments to his or her own plan. That strikes me as real participation. Am I right about that, that's a give on the side of those supporting this plan?
Representative Kopp.
Madam Chair, and through the chair, yes, Representative Josephson, it's a significant give. For instance, when I retired as a Tier 2 employee at 44 years of age, I was able to have a medical and a cash benefit. This now, a person in a similar circumstance as me with 20 years would have to, they would have no benefit for 11 more years before they could draw that. It would be waiting for them, but they would need another job. Hopefully, if they didn't get hurt on the job, they would be in physical condition to go out and continue. I can tell you at my age now, I'm 54, so I would still be 1 year away. I am glad I don't have to wrestle people anymore. You know, that takes a toll on your body. When I was 44, it was hard on my body. So we are asking them to make a sacrifice. This is a significantly different plan than what we've had before.
So, Mr. Fornia, we're very happy that you were here today, but unfortunately we are going to have to delay the rest of this presentation, as we have many in the room and online who would like to testify on this. So we will work with Representative Kopp on having you back at a later time. But with that, I'm going to go ahead and open up public testimony on HB 79. And we're going to start with...
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We're going to start in the room, and we have Paul Miranda, and followed by Jeremy Conklin. If you both want to come to the table, we can be filling the empty chair. You can please put yourself on the record and your affiliation. You may begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Miranda, and I'm testifying today on behalf of the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association. I'm also an 8-year firefighter paramedic with the Anchorage Fire Department and a Tier 4 member. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I would like to say thank you to Representative Kopp and his staff for their work on House Bill 79, and thank you to the committee for hearing the bill. In 2006, Alaska began placing all new state and municipal employees into the new defined contribution plan known as Tier 4. Since the change to Tier 4, our state has experienced many unintended consequences. Perhaps the clearest consequence is the competitive disadvantage Alaska now faces in recruiting and retaining public safety employees. The problem is widespread throughout Alaska's fire and police departments. It has been brought to our attention in many letters from fire and police chiefs from across the state, as well as extensive testimony in the House Labor and Commerce Committee. Alaska is the only state in our country to offer a mandatory defined contribution retirement plan to public safety employees. And several jurisdictions across the country have switched from a defined contribution plan back to a defined benefit plan to address the problems that we are now seeing in Alaska today. Another unintended consequence from the switch to Tier 4 is the lack of retirement security that Tier 4 provides for our public safety employees who dedicate a career to serving Alaska in jobs that will take a very physical and mental toll. For years, our professional actuaries have told us that Tier 4 will be inadequate for public safety and retirement. However, this has now been validated by testimony of the state investment officer at a 2018 Alaska Retirement Management Board meeting, as well as additional predictions from the Department of Administration. There's no longer a question of whether or not Tier 4 works for public safety. It simply does not. To make matters worse, most firefighters in Alaska do not receive Social Security or SBS. They only receive a 5% contribution to a 401(a) account. To be clear, for Alaska's firefighters, the state of Alaska contributes less to our Tier 4 accounts than a Social Security contribution would be in the private sector. This is the value that the state has placed on our first responders. I've heard people say that most of the problems with recruitment and retention are due to a lack of information or education about the benefits of the DC Tier 4 plan. I am here to disagree. The more I learn about Tier 4, the worse it looks for public safety. I am educated, and no amount of education will convince me that Tier 4 is adequate for public safety or is competitive with other agencies offer, with what other agencies offer their employees. House Bill 79 aims to make Alaska competitive in the hiring and retaining of public safety employees. It's a conservative plan built by incorporating the best practices of some of the most successful plans in our country. It works to provide reasonable, competitive benefits and at the same time protect the state from adverse experience. All of the tools and benefit modifications in HB 79 help to build a reasonable and conservative retirement plan for public safety employees, reduce risk for the state, make Alaska competitive in the recruitment and retention of public safety employees, and provide a secure retirement for our first responders. This is a bill that both management and labor strongly agree on. Becoming competitive will help Alaska's public safety agencies retain highly skilled employees and better fulfill their missions and responsibilities to the communities they serve, as well as preserve important dollars being lost when employees leave our state. On behalf of the over 500 professional firefighters in Alaska, the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association strongly supports House Bill 79 and recognizes that it's a good compromise to address the issues that face public safety in Alaska today. We can't afford to do nothing to address these issues. The costs are too great. And on a quick personal note, I was born and raised in Alaska. I've thought very seriously about leaving. I realize that the unfortunate reality of what Tier 4 provides will not be adequate to provide for myself and my family in retirement. What has kept me here is not Tier 4 retirement. Maybe I'm naive, but I'm an optimist. What has kept me here is my optimism that the legislature will recognize this problem and will do the right thing to fix it. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Jeremy Conklin. And in the other seat, if Tyler Greensfeder could please come take the other seat. Tyler, if you could please put yourself on the record and your affiliation.
Yes, my name is Jeremy Conkling. You wanted me to go, though,
yeah,
right?
No, you did.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. I'm Jeremy Conkling. I'm a sergeant with the Anchorage Police Department, and I'm president of the Anchorage Police Department Employees Association. I'm here today on behalf of the over 550 members across 22 job classifications within the Anchorage Police Department to urge you all to support the passage of HB 79. I want to speak specifically to the issues that a lack of a defined benefit are causing us and what I have seen firsthand. I can tell you that law enforcement is in the midst of a recruiting crisis that we have, the likes of which we have never seen before. There are agencies all over this country competing for qualified and certified lateral police officers. There are agencies like the Seattle Police Department who post billboards outside the headquarters of the Indianapolis Police Department saying, we'll pay you more money, move to Seattle. They place billboards in Honolulu going after those officers. They come after our officers. We get job postings that come from out-of-state agencies in our squad room where our police officers show up for work every day. All of them highlight the fact that Alaska does not have a defined benefit, and these other states do. In the last 2 months, I've had two of my members leave the Anchorage Police Department to go to a state with a defined benefit. The first was to Phoenix, Arizona. It was a five-year officer, a member of our SWAT team, an instructor in our academy, a field training officer. I know that you all were provided a study done by DPS in 2017 that said the average cost was about $190,000 to train a state trooper. I would ask you to extrapolate that out over a five-year period and take into account the specialized training that these officers have, and that cost suddenly skyrockets. The second officer that left was for Richardson, Texas, was allowed to come in with requisite experience, meaning they accepted the 3.5 years he had at the Anchorage Police Department and based his salary off of that. He will make $300 a month less than what he makes in Anchorage. I'm not sure if any of you have been to Richardson, Texas, but the cost of living there is nowhere near what it is in Anchorage. He's going to a defined benefit. He's going to have the same salary, essentially, a much higher quality of life, and a much lower cost of living. There is no way we can continue to retain these officers and compete against these other agencies until we get a fix to our defined benefit, until we get a fix to our defined contribution. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. The next one up will be Nathan Ellis in the empty seat. Tyler?
Hi, my name is Tyler Greensfelder. I was born and raised in, or I was raised in Alaska. I currently live in the Mat-Su Valley, and I'm a product of Alaska. What I mean by that is the Chugiaki River community raised me through unforeseen life circumstances. So I try to give back to that community at any time that I can, whether it's through community band, volunteering at Mirror Lake Middle School as a wrestling coach, and more. Those circumstances led to me getting a scholarship and going to our great University of Alaska system up in Fairbanks. I then went through the university fire science program, got paid experience as a firefighter there, and ultimately landed my dream career at working at the Anchorage Fire Department. Today I come to you as a concerned citizen, an Anchorage firefighter, a husband, and more recently a father to a five-month-old. Living in Alaska is all I know, but recently I did the unthinkable. 4 days ago I got back from Washington. I saw a job posting online, followed up with it because it appeared too good to be true, visited and decided I could see myself raising my family and living there. I have applied to the Everett Fire Department. They're offering a lateral position, meaning I go there at the top step pay with no written test, one interview, and an extremely accelerated academy. Going into a place that has a defined benefit contribution system that is managed so well, they're over 100% funded, and a healthcare component with inside that local department that bridges from the time you retire until Medicare age. The lack of defined benefit system in Alaska is literally tearing my family apart. We will be leaving grandparents, aunts, and uncles, all that live within 20 minutes of where I do. Alaska needs a solution to the amount of money that's being hemorrhaged by Alaska training the Pacific Northwest public safety system. Of course, there's a small price to pay to give Alaska public safety members a dignified retirement, but inaction will cost the state more money. I know at least six members, some that are on the phones right now, that have left personally for other, that have left their families here in Alaska for other defined benefit systems in the Pacific Northwest. As a firefighter, we're called to problems large and small and to come up with solutions. We are giving you the opportunity to be political firefighters and put this fire out by supporting HB 79, which RepCop has sponsored. The bill that is before you is widely supported as reasonable, sensible, and a good deal for both state and the workers. It is modeled after Washington and Wisconsin system that are two of the best in the nation. I have friends that work for the troopers, Anchorage Airport Police and Fire, APD, and AFD, and they all support this bill. I urge you not to delay this process, but to enable it and push this through the committee and onto the House floor for a vote as soon as possible. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Tyler?
Hello, my name is Nathan Ellis. I'm with the Alaska Professional Firefighter Association. I'm also a captain, paramedic with the Anchorage Fire Department. I want to share with you guys a little bit about my background. I'm a third generation Alaskan. My family owns and runs a hunting lodge on the north side of the Wrangells since the 1950s. My wife is Alaska native. She comes from Chiniga, which is in Prince William Sound. She's Aleutic. We have two kids, 3-year-old and 5-year-old. We live in Girdwood. I've been with Anchorage Fire Department now for 12 years, but I came from working in Nevada from a defined benefit system. I came here knowing it was defined contribution because of my love of Alaska and because these are where my roots are, where my family is. So I'm kind of the opposite side of this coin. You know, we talk a lot of it about recruitment and retention. I'm that side of the coin. I'm not going to go anywhere. I'm 46 years old. I'm not going to go somewhere and start another career. My body cannot handle another academy. Trust me, it's hard on you. This job is hard on you. I think about when my kids are able to go to college, and maybe when they're out of college. Maybe you all, you know, you want to get your kids through college as you're working. It's another 20 years. And in 20 years, I'll be 66, crawling in and out of a fire truck, lifting people downstairs, crawling into burning buildings. I don't think my body can make it. I was told by an orthopedic surgeon I'm going to need a hip in 5 years. I'm going to try to stretch that out, hopefully to 10. And maybe all of you have gone through something like that before, but it's a life changer. So I'm the other side of that coin. I'm the aging workforce that you're going to see. I'm the workman's comp claim. I'm the disability. And I don't want to be. I'm going to push through that point for my family. Or the other option is to go find another career. So, you know, this whole tier four, tier three on to tier five, tier four came about because of some mismanagement for our other systems, right? We just had that. And so now we basically stripped it and there's nothing. If you want to fix the problem, which we're talking about, I think there's going to have to be something that we give. And that's all we're asking for here is we give a bit, but then also the state, the legislative gives a bit also. And we're just people up here, just as you are. And we're trying to provide for our families, trying to think of our future. So please consider this bill as just that, as taking care of our people that every day take care of all of us. And that's all I have. Thank you very much for your time and your work. I do appreciate it.
Thank you. And online we have Chief Dahl, Chief Police of the Police of Anchorage. Chief Dahl.
I heard somebody calling for Chief Dahl. This is Chief Shiragi.
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay, so who do we have?
This is Chief Dahl with Anchorage PD.
Okay, if you go ahead and, well, you've obviously put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Again, this is Justin Dahl, Chief of Police with the Anchorage Police Department. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the committee today. I just want to share a couple of my concerns. You know, as chief of Alaska's largest law enforcement agency, my concerns are primarily operational. We have been very fortunate to run consecutive academies at APD for the last few years, and we have successfully been recruiting qualified applicants, and that's been very good for our agency. However, as some of the previous speakers have mentioned, we're starting to face kind of that same recruiting crisis that much of the rest of the country has seen over the last few years. The last couple of academies that we had we really did not meet our recruiting goals. We were short by about 10 recruit officers per academy of what we would have liked to have. And so I think that we're starting to see the effect of, you know, not being quite as competitive as some of the agencies in the lower 48. We do recruit heavily from the Anchorage area, and we've actually, especially in the last year and a half or so, really been extending our recruiting efforts across the state to try to get people into Anchorage. But we've been very fortunate in the last few years to have quite a bit of success of bringing qualified people up from outside, which I think, frankly, is good for Anchorage to have people moving to the state that are bringing their families with them and are sort of ready, willing, and able to be part of the workforce and part of public safety in Anchorage. The other primary concern besides recruiting that I have is retention of officers. Right now, APD is about 430 sworn police officers, and about one in five of those officers falls into a category where they have more than 5 years on, but less than 13. So they're sort of in that, they're in tier four, they're fully vested, they could pick up everything that they have put into the system and walk away with it, but obviously with less than 13 years, you know, they're not in tier three. So those folks are very portable. I think Sergeant Conkling mentioned earlier that he had seen some people leave, and I would just verify that that's been the case. We've had some experienced officers leaving. The people that are in that 5 to 13 year range, it's about 75 to 80 officers here at APD. They're very valuable. We've invested a lot of money in their initial training, and then for the most part, we've invested additional money in follow-on training, whether that's training them to be part of the SWAT team or to be field training officers or crisis intervention officers or whatever. So I'm actually, as a chief, very, very concerned about retaining those people, especially because they're such a large part of the police department. We also have a very large segment of our workforce that is in the over 20-year range, and so they're eligible to retire under Tier 3 or one of the previous PERS systems. And so that kind of ties back into my concern about recruiting. We just Anchorage is poised. We're in very, very good shape today, but we're poised to maybe be in very poor shape in the near future if a lot of our people leave all at once. So I just want to make sure that we have we're offering the best possible package when we're trying to recruit new people to come to Anchorage. I'll keep it relatively short. I know the committee has been bombarded with a lot of information today, and so I'm not going to throw lots and lots of numbers and figures at you. I just want you to understand that from a chief of police perspective, as an administrator, I have this growing concern about our ability to attract and retain officers, and I think that the proposal that's before you is very responsible, and as an administrator who's also responsible for a budget, I like the fact that there's not an increased cost to the municipality as far as contributions go between Tier 4 and Tier 5. So other than that, I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you for being with us today. We appreciate what you do. Back to the room.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Angie Fraze, followed by Kevin Johnson. Welcome, Angie.
Good afternoon. My name is Angie Fraze. I am with the APDEA as well as Jeremy Conklin. I'm also a police officer with the Anchorage Police Department. I live in Chugiak with my husband, who's also a police officer, and we have two kids. I think these guys did a great job talking about our perspective from the Anchorage Police Department and what this means to us. It obviously means a lot. We've been fighting for a reasonable solution for many, many years. I'd like to just give you a few seconds of the personal side of it. I accidentally came into law enforcement. I never, ever imagined being a police officer. I'd had, you know, a speeding ticket when I was 16, and that's what I knew about being a police officer. And so when my husband, I went outside, I'm born and raised in Alaska, and when I went outside for college, I met my husband who wanted to be a police officer. Pretty intimidating, but we came back to Alaska, which is my home, and he went through the police academy in 2001. So we're coming up on being 20 years in law enforcement as a family. And if you know any law enforcement families, they're very, very different than other families. When we go to Costco, we hold our kids closer when we're taking samples because sometimes there's people who recognize us. Being two police officers, we may have arrested people just out in our small community. So we definitely have a plan of evacuation. We have a plan to, you know, protect our kids. Our kids know from a young age what it's like to have two cop parents. And so that's something that, being in law enforcement, there needs to be an end date in sight for that. Like, this is not something that we can maintain for 30 years. So luckily, we got into a situation. I'm a tier three employee. I'm in that plan, and I see an end in the future. But in my job, I do backgrounds and recruiting. I see for the last, 10 years or so, people coming in the door, and for half of my career, people didn't talk about finding other jobs. This last 10 years, that's all people talk about. They talk about looking for other jobs. They talk as soon as they're out of the academy. They're not talking about that end date of being a police officer. They're talking about where else can I get a better deal. And that's scary for me because I will always be an Anchorage citizen with my family. And I want the leaders in 10 years to be the people who have that experience, the people who respond to those 911 calls, being those people who have the experience and the education, not the people who have just learning the job. I want those leaders of our department in 10, 15, 20 years to be those people who have been around, not just 5, 7 years on because they didn't find a better place to go or a better retirement system. So I urge you to consider this. I think it's a very reasonable fix to a problem that we've been facing for 10 years. And just as a citizen and as a police officer, I hope that you see it's a long-term solution. So I appreciate your time to talk to you guys today.
Thank you. We appreciate what you do. Kevin?
For the record, my name is Kevin Johnson. It's very nice to be sitting in front of you all. I'm a sixth generation Alaskan. Six generations of my family has been here. A gentleman known to you as John Butrovich, my great-great uncle, walked through these halls and conducted his business in this building here. My grandfather was one of the very first opticians to fly out to the village and provide eye care to the native communities out in those villages. My homestead was Browns Hill Quarry. My family has been in Alaska trying to help the citizens of Alaska all of our lives. And as a current Tier 4 retirement employee of Fairbanks Fire Department, and an educator of the Alaska University of Alaska Fairbanks, I am actually looking at leaving the state. This is six generations stopping here in pursuit of better wages and absolutely better retirement. You go anywhere else, you can find defined benefit retirement, and it's very lucrative. Another horrifying point to this is roughly a quarter of our department at Fairbanks Fire in the next 2 years is stepping out. They are retiring. They are old. They are unfortunately broken. And they have to step out. The terrifying thing about this is nobody is stepping up to take their place because of better opportunities elsewhere in the United States. Our last academy, we were slated to hire six. We had to extend the recruitment period 3 times to be able to fill that applicant pool. We didn't have enough people applying because the longevity was not there. Of those six that were eventually hired, one of them stepped out to go to Fort Wainwright because they offered him divine benefit and better health benefits. Of the 8 we have hired in the last year, I know of 6 of us who are looking at stepping out of the state of Alaska in pursuit of better places to raise families and to retire comfortably and without worry of what the future holds. House Bill 79 would absolutely put our minds at rest and help us get recruitment, retain people, and have a active, complete fire service that can actually protect the community for years to come. I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Going back online, Justin Mack. You can put yourself on the record and your affiliation. Go ahead, Justin.
Good afternoon. My name is Justin Mack. I'm an Anchorage firefighter, Native Alaskan, and Tier 4 member. Thank you for taking the time to hear this bill. I would like to comment on some of the statements that retirement and benefits made in a previous hearing before this body. Retirement benefits explain that DB plans eventually lead to an unfunded liability that rests solely on the state. While this has been Alaska's experience in the past, it certainly is not the case around the country. well-run and modest DB plans make states competitive while also remaining fully funded. Without getting into all the factors that keep this plan stable, I would like to focus on medical. This hybrid retirement offers DB benefits that do not change without onboard action and a medical component that is the same as Tier 4, which is, does not afford any medical liability on the state, but rather the pre-Medicare costs rest on the employee. This is one of the great compromises that this bill offers. Both sides share in the benefit of a defined benefit retirement system in a way of recruitment and retention for the employer and a dignified retirement for Alaska's public safety workers that allows us to forecast and budget after the age of 55. The state will no longer carry the high cost of pre-medical as a factor which affects the pension system. The cost associated with medical falls to the employee. Now, this is not ideal, and I'll be the first to say that Alaska public safety members earn every bit of their retirement. The medical should be a part of that. The fact that we're agreeing to carry the medical costs goes to show that this is a modest plan. When retirement and benefits say that risk falls on one side and not the other, I feel it is a little bit misleading. This bill offers a modest benefit with shared risk between the employers and Alaska's public safety workers. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And next will be Doug Schrage. Doug?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill and for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Doug Schrage, and I'm representing the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. I will be brief. This is a management problem, and the problem is very real. Municipal fire departments have become revolving doors, essentially training grounds for fire departments in other states, particularly in the Pacific Northwest. Firefighters have been hiring on to Alaska fire departments, getting trained, and then serving out their probationary periods. And then many are being recruited to fire departments in Washington. Fire departments in the Pacific Northwest are increasingly doing lateral hires, which means their new firefighters from Alaska can skip the usual training and go right to a post-probationary pay rate. The fire departments then save the cost of recruiting and training their new firefighters. Meanwhile, Alaska's fire departments are recruiting, training, and equipping firefighters at significant expense on a nearly perpetual basis. A byproduct is that our fire departments are now becoming populated with newer and less experienced firefighters that don't stay long enough to accrue valuable experience. This outmigration seems to have increased significantly following the implementation of Tier 4. During my career, prior to 2008 or so, it was virtually unheard of for firefighters to leave their jobs for other states. Another phenomenon I've observed is that fewer Alaskans seem to be applying for firefighting jobs in Alaska, likely also due to Tier 4. So I echo the comments and the concerns of the speakers who went before me, and again, I thank you for bringing this bill and for the opportunity to contribute.
Thank you, Mr. Schrage. Always good to hear from you. Next is Casey Luker with the Kenai Fire Department.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Casey Luker. I'm a firefighter paramedic with the City of Kenai Fire Department. I have worked here for 9 years, and I'm currently a Tier 4 member. I'm calling to advocate my support for HB 79, and for a couple of reasons. In my tenure here, I have seen three firefighters of similar experience to myself leave for out of state for defined benefits or defined benefits programs, and we're looking at a gap in experience. We're still able to attract new applicants. Our minimum requirements are firefighter one, 18 years of age, EMT one, which not really hard to obtain, but then we hire on these firefighters, we train them, and then a majority, well, so far only three, but we're at 15. We're a 15 line personnel department. We're a small department, so one-fifth of the department has left for defined benefit programs since I've been here. We're left with this gap where we have more senior Tier 3 members that are verging their retirement, and we're left with this experience gap where we have fewer members that are ready to step into leadership roles, that it weakens the organization as a whole. Their experience just is not there. And on a personal note, I am a fifth-generation Alaskan. A lot of my personal identity is wrapped into being an Alaskan, and I myself am considering a lateral transfer to a place like Washington where I could be part of a defined benefits program. Recently became a father, and I feel that I'm kind of posed with the choice of providing for my own retirement or providing for my son's education. And it's a hard position to be in, and I really hope that this bill is considered. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And next we have Cody Carver from the Bellingham Fire Department.
Hello?
Hello? Can you put yourself on the record?
Can everyone hear me?
We can.
Yeah, good afternoon. My name is Cody Carver. I'm a firefighter with the Bellingham Fire Department here in Washington, and I've been a firefighter for 9 years now. However, I was born and raised in Sedona, Alaska, and spent a great deal of my time growing up in Anchorage with local sports. In 2009, I moved to Fairbanks, Alaska to work at the University Fire Department and to go to paramedic school, where I spent 4 years of my time. After this, I moved to Juneau, Alaska to work for Capital City Fire and Rescue as a career firefighter paramedic for 1.5 years. And then I moved to Anchorage to work for the Anchorage Fire Department for nearly 4 years as a career firefighter paramedic. The Anchorage Fire Department is where I wanted to work for and retire from because that's where my friends and family are from. However, after educating myself more about what the Tier 4 retirement system had to offer for a pension and a disability, I decided to explore my options in Washington and the Pacific Northwest for two reasons. One, the uncertainty of a defined contribution retirement plan. And two, what if I get injured on the job and I can't return to work? Tier 4 will not protect you or support your family, and I've witnessed this firsthand. There are many departments in the Washington area that are hiring lateral firefighters, which means they're hiring firefighters with experience, and that's what I did here in Bellingham. And there's perks for both the firefighters and the city with this. As a lateral firefighter, you generally are going to have higher wages. When compared to entry-level firefighters, you're going to have more sick leave, and you have a vacation bank. And this is appealing to someone in my position who's starting over with a new department. The city's also going to save money with a lateral academy because they're generally shorter than an entry-level academy. My academy here in Bellingham was only 6 weeks compared to my entry-level academy in Anchorage, over 3 months. There are many departments in Washington that are offering comparable pay, good benefits, but ultimately a pension with disability, and that's the reason why I'm here now. And really, to put everything in perspective, if there was a pension for Tier 4 members, I would have never have left the Anchorage Fire Department. I strongly urge your support for House Bill 79. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Cody. Next will be Steve Nelson.
Hello. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Nelson. I'm the Executive Director of the Law Enforcement Officers and Firefighters Retirement Plan 2 in the state of Washington. Our plan started in 1977. We cover all the law enforcement officers and firefighters in the state. That's currently 18,000 active members and a little over 4,000 retirees. We've got about $11 billion in assets. We're currently 109% funded, and our funding ratio has been at or over 100% since the plan inception in 1977. Because of the success of our plan, I'm frequently asked to speak on best practices for public safety defined benefit plans. I was asked to review the proposed plan that you have before you today in HB 79 and offer a few quick comments on parts of the plan, provisions of the plan that would be considered best practices. The cost-sharing mechanism between employees and employers, where the employee rate is not fixed but can rise if necessary. That's a best practice. Your five-year final average salary period, that we have that exact same provision here in Washington. It's been very effective in preventing salary spiking. The retirement age that you have, 55 with a 20-year requirement, that's a very reasonable retirement age provision. You've got conservative actuarial assumptions, and you've got the medical benefits separated out from the pension plan. Those five provisions really jumped out at me as best practices, and I know you've got a room full of people there, but I would be happy to answer questions that you have. I listened to the number of people that have come to Washington or are considering coming to Washington that have testified before you today, so I understand sort of the role our plan, the success of our plan has had in that recruiting. I hope you won't hold that against me.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Our next testifier will show you can never really leave Juneau. Representative Seaton, please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. This is Paul Seaton, representing myself, and I was involved in the redoing of the retirement system in 2005, and I, recommend caution. Actuaries across the country that have had a terrible record of trying to make correct assumptions over time. In fact, almost all of the retirement plans, with few exceptions, are terribly underwater. In fact, in 2003, when I came in, we had $15.6 billion of unfunded scheduled payments in 2003. Now, the net present value of that, if we would put $2.3 billion of cash in and it had grown at 8% over time, that would have taken care of it. But, of course, those things aren't done at the time, and we didn't have $2 billion to put into that. We've tried over time to do that, but that actuarial assumption has eaten our lunch, as well as most other states over time. One thing about the defined retirement or defined benefit plan was that the money, that vesting didn't occur for 10 years, and that the average employment status of people was 9.5 years in the PERS system. So that meant about half of the people, when they left the system, they could take the money that they had contributed to the system, but the money that had been contributed by their employers stayed in the system. And so even with that additional benefit of almost half of the people, the money staying in the system, we still had this $15.6 billion of unscheduled payments. So I also caution that treating police and fire employees so separately from all other state employees will not last, as it's so discriminatory in future legislatures. And so I worry about going that way, and I just urge caution, as well as I hope you'll look at when people talk about overfunding, the ad hoc PRPA that mandates that the extra money be paid out to members of the system. So thank you. Appreciate you looking at the system, but I do urge caution.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for calling in. Next is Jacob Wilson.
Good afternoon. My name is Jacob Wilson. I'm with the Alaska Correctional Officers Association, and we represent 890 or so correctional officers working in 12 institutions throughout Alaska. I'm here speaking in support of HB 79. Alaska is in the middle of the most significant law enforcement, recruitment, and retention crisis in our history. One of the root causes of this crisis in Alaska is Alaska's defined contribution retirement system, which simply is not competitive with other law enforcement agencies around the country. In the 2016 CGL study of the Alaska DOC found, and I quote, our analysis indicated that a number of facilities are currently operating with staffing levels insufficient to meet basic security operational requirements. Since FY14, we've lost 540 correctional officers from state service. That equates to over 60% of our current workforce. We've estimated that loss of officers cost the state approximately $15 million annually. To illustrate how officers are leaving at the five-year mark, we currently have about 110 Tier 4 officers between 4 to 5 years of service. That number drops by more than in half to 45 officers with 5 to 6 years of service and 35 officers in the 6 to 7 years of service range. With the current retirement system, there simply isn't enough of an incentive for officers to stay past their five-year mark when they can withdraw their retirement contributions and, now with our training, move on to another law enforcement agency with a defined benefit retirement system. Ours is a profession where experience matters and impacts officer and inmate safety. New officers do not necessarily have the experience to anticipate an assault before it happens or save a life by intervening with a suicidal inmate. We need experience within our institutions. The Alaska Correctional Officers Association believes the passage of HB 79 will help curb the recruitment and retention problems plaguing the Department of Corrections, and we urge its passage. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Michael Oden. If you please put yourself on the record and your affiliation, please.
My name is Michael Oden. I'm a resident of the Kenai Peninsula and representing myself. I'm currently an employee with the City of Kenai Fire Department. I've been a full-time firefighter for 7 years, four years with the City of Kenai. I'm a third-generation Alaskan firefighter. In addition to that, I also have a grandfather who retired as Alaska State Troopers after 20 years of service. I'm calling in to support a defined benefits plan. It seems like HB 79, it shows the defined benefit for our public safety employees that I believe it to be acceptable to retain the highest quality employees for Alaska. I have multiple friends that I received fire science and emergency medical training with up at UAF in Fairbanks. A lot of that training paid for by local departments through taxpayer, fire service areas. And a lot of those guys and gals have taken their training elsewhere to work in the Pacific Northwest. And when we look at states like Washington, Idaho, and Oregon, they all have just fantastic defined benefits program and really high wages. I don't want to come across as, entitled and think that, our police and firefighter maybe need something better than teachers or like a state heavy equipment operator, for example. And I think that our community is great at showing support for us after big events like local events like wildfires or like World Trade Center disaster or the firefighters in Paris saving the Notre Dame Church. But what are we doing for our firefighters and our police officers after those big events when they retire? We have to really take care of those employees. The number one cause of firefighter death in the United States is sudden cardiac arrest. The likelihood of a firefighter experiencing a heart attack is greatly increased, obviously, as you age. Under the current plan, we'll likely have firefighters and police officers working into their 60s as public safety officers in order to have enough money in their 401. Some municipalities like mine, they don't pay into Social Security, and nor do they offer an SPS. Most Alaskans would not expect a senior citizen to be the one wrestling bad guys to the ground to keep their streets safe or hop off a fire engine, start searching at home during a structure fire. Mr. Westcott mentioned the increase in workers' comp claims as employees age. So I'm speaking from personal experience. I just sustained a work-related back injury while lifting a patient to an ambulance under just normal EMS operation. This occurred at age 25 for me. Our ambulance journeys weigh just under 100 pounds. After that, a 200-pound patient, you're continually lifting this person, 300-pound patient package in and out of the ambulance throughout the day, unloading at the hospital. The likelihood of injury can easily be surmised to increase if a 59-and-a-half-year-old is squatting 300 pounds in and out of an ambulance multiple times a day. Not only do we want to provide the best retirement situation possible for our public safety employees, we also want to keep our employees that we have paid to train. We want to keep them here in Alaska. I don't
St. Louis local governments will be able to afford to keep sending this revolving door of police officers to their police academies or their EMS providers to paramedic level training. This current trajectory is guys and gals transferring out to other other communities outside the state. Our fire and EMS certifications have national reciprocity in most cases, which means they can be taken anywhere. And our law enforcement officers are able to do lateral transfers to most states in the lower 48 with just a short lateral academy. With the current Tier 4, 401 style plan, we can leave at any time because they don't have their hooks set in us like they would if we had a pension system. HB 79 has many compromises, including age requirement for withdrawal, a lack of inflation adjustment if needed, and a five-year average salary to account for any spike in pay anomalies. This would be a great step forward to improve our public safety retirement situation. And with these changes, I truly believe that we'll be able to retain more troopers, police officers, firefighters, COs working here in Alaska. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I have no one else signed up. Is there anyone else online? Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on HB 79? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony on HB 79. Are you wanting to testify, Representative Josephson? Okay. So we're going to close testimony, come back to the room. Representative Josephson, do you have a comment?
I have a comment and then a couple questions.
Okay.
My first comment is for Mr. Greensfelder. I would ask Mr. Greensfelder, today's the 18th of April, and if he can wait, and I know he's waited, but I'd ask him to hang in there for 1 year from today. I think he has a good sponsor, and I think the administration would support this. And I'd ask him, I don't want to lose him. I want him to think about sticking around. That's my comment. My question is about two issues. Through the chair, the first question is this workers' comp issue. If firefighters, for example, would have to work until, they don't have to work till 55, but they can't enjoy the benefit till 55. So I guess I'm answering this for myself as I'm thinking out loud. The concern with workers' comp, with the firefighter, the gentleman who was 46, I'll just put it this way, for Mr. Ellis, how is that resolved by this bill? I don't quite understand that part.
Representative Kopp.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. So there's a difference between a disability benefit, mm-hmm. which if you qualify is immediately available to you under your plan, and then a workman's comp claim. And I would defer to my staff or my trustee Tom Westcott here, who is more our in-house expert on injuries on the job. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think the testimony was that at his age and, you know, he would not be moving to this plan on it. So I don't think he was comparing it to workers' comp. But go ahead, Mr. Westcott.
Through the chair, thank you. I don't want to leave the impression that this bill solves every problem. As we've heard, the medical is going to be a big problem. There are going to be problems with workers' comp. In my experience in the fire service, I've seen people who have been able to work past 55, and I've seen people who had to make a choice that their body just couldn't do it. We're given physicals every year, and we have standards, and a simple thing like being put on a blood thinner can end your career. There's a lot of, whether it's AFib, or there's a lot of medical problems where your doctor could say, you're on a blood thinner, you can no longer work as a firefighter if that's to happen. So I don't want to say this bill is going to solve every problem. We still have a responsibility to personally save in preparation for retirement. This pension plan isn't going to provide enough to live on with health care. There's personal responsibility built into this plan that goes along, but it's just about not having all of your eggs in one basket, so to speak. Everything is market-based and on an individual level under Tier 4. Under this plan, the individual has a responsibility to save and prepare for retirement, and then you have a more stable benefit that doesn't have to diversify and reduce risk as it ages, like an individual would.
Follow-up?
Actually, it's not technically a follow-up, but it's the same bill, of course. So
that would be helpful.
All right. Diminution of benefits, illegal under our Constitution. What happens where you take less because of the PRPA adjustment or that sort of thing? Is there any concern that even though you want the bill, that you run into some problem there?
Through the chair, because it is it's written into the legislation that this is the benefit and the ability exists to withhold, that is different than from like trying to withhold it from the other tiers where it was written in that this adjustment is given automatically every year. So because at the start the promise is you'll get it if the funding level is above 90% or you know, when the ARM board determines, it's not a diminishment. And I'm not a lawyer, but that's the way it's been explained to me when they have looked at it.
Mr. Truitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Ken Truitt, staff for Representative Kopp, and I am a lawyer, and I would say that for a firefighter, you do pretty good for for explaining that. I think, Representative Joseph, that's a really great question, a great observation. I also think that if the ARM board decided to reduce that PPRA benefit at 95% of funding, I think that would run into a constitutional issue. I think if we didn't build that in and we tried to do it, then that would also run into the constitutional issue that you're referring to.
Any other questions? We're going to be setting this bill aside. We have actuaries that we'll be waiting on, as well as a presentation that we will also schedule to finish. And with that, on Monday, April 22nd, 2019, at 1:30, we will hear House Bill 114, Medical Provider Incentives and Loans. And if it's the intent of the committee, we will be moving HB 41 Shellfish Enhancement Projects and Hatcheries and HB 87 Liquefied Natural Gas Storage Tax Credits. If anyone has an issue with any of those, please contact me so we can work those out, hopefully before Monday. And with that, it's 3:47, and we're adjourned.